Welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast hosted by DSI. I'm Zach Fagan, and here we are today with Kelly Becker of Tim Barber Architects. Kelly, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited for this discussion.
Yeah. So let's dive right in. Talk a little bit about how you got into architecture originally.
Yeah, I think when you're a kid and people are asking you, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? There's like all sorts of dreams. And then you reach that point in high school where you're like, what do you want to major in? It becomes a reality. So I took some time to really reflect on, like, what am I good at and what do I want to do? I was good at math, and I knew that I wanted to do something that would challenge me creatively so that I wouldn't be kind of in the cycle of doing the same process over and over, which just is not fulfilling, you know? So I had a friend whose father was an architect. I would go to their house often, and he'd have the drafting table out and models on the wall, and he was very talented at drawing, so he had some hand drawings, and I think that really influenced me. So I just jumped in, applied to the undergrad architecture program, the University of Illinois in Chicago. And what better place to learn about architecture than that city? It's incredible. So I think I was lucky in the fact that I just learned more and I was more interested in it as I went along. I think some people don't really find a passion that quickly, and perhaps I stumbled upon it, but I was lucky enough to really enjoy it. And specifically, the tradition of architecture and historic architecture, just looking at the precedent, I find a lot of inspiration in what people did before, the lessons that we can learn. And so I think eventually moving out here to California, I went to USC, worked for an architectural historian for a few years, and then found my way to Tim Barber Architects, where like dreaming up people's homes, the place that they will create their memories, is just, I think it's a really special type of architecture.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. So, how has math, being good at math, really played any specific role in your success in architecture?
I'm still terrible at on the spot math. I could be better at that, but I think that just the mentality that math brings, the problem solving aspect of it, we are problem solvers in all shapes and forms of it. So I think just being able to take that, you see the problem, you can kind of discover options to solve that. That's what I bring from that.
For sure. Very cool. Very cool. Interesting. So you've grown, at the firm, obviously, from being a design associate in 2013, to now principal and design director. What are some of the key steps and lessons in that journey with Tim Barber?
Well, I think I have learned that, I'm incredibly self-motivated and I'm not afraid to speak up. And those things have served me. So starting as a design associate, and I was there for a few years really learning. And I knew that I wanted to be a project manager because just the kind of the freedom to lead your projects. And it just seemed like sort of the typical architecture path. I never imagined that I would become a partner at the firm. That was something that in our firm, we set goals. And so there was one meeting that we what do you really want to do in 5 years? And I didn't know, other than just, I would like to be the best at what I am and bringing that up with my team. And I think Tim saw that kind of drive and focus in me. And so I was very honored to be one of his selections. So myself and David Stone are new partners. We became partners about a year ago.
Very cool. How's David?
David's great. Yeah.
I haven't seen him.
He's running it.
I've seen him in a minute.
Yeah.
So can you share an example of a project where, you know, listening to the client's lifestyle transformed the design in a specific way?
All of our projects are that way. I think before we even draw anything, we sit down with the owner. We call it the uptake meeting, and we just talk and we ask them what are their needs for their current life. You know, everything from do you entertain? We get really invasive, like where do you put your toothbrush? So it's just you can't design a custom home without knowing how people live their lives. And we also have conversations about the future, like, what happens if your kids move out and you have grandkids? You might still want to keep that bathtub, like things like that, where just, or aging in place. We really talk with them about what they need now, what they will need so that the home can grow with them. And an example is I'm working with a family up north in the Atherton area. They came to us about 12 years ago when I first started with Tim. And they, a young family, three kids, and their needs then were very different. They needed durable materials. They needed drop zones. They needed a study desk and a playroom. And they've come back. So we're working with them for phase two. And their kids are in high school and just about to move out. And their needs have changed. And so that playroom is now a teen hangout, like a media room. And they're changing some of the things that they discovered along the way that don't serve them anymore, and also planning for the next 12 years.
Wow. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Atherton's beautiful.
It really is. Absolutely. Yeah.
Beautiful area. So that's very interesting. I think that, we evolve as people, as time goes on, our needs change. And I think that's definitely something unique. I haven't heard that before. As you said, you get very invasive. Mm-hmm. And that turns out to be a very good thing. It's paying dividends where you've got customers coming back that are, so appreciative of the way that you work that, 12 years later, sure, they're coming back to do more business. It's very cool. So DSI is collaborating with TBA on a project over in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. How do you approach renovations as opposed to brand new builds, right? That project is a renovation. What are some of the key differences between the way you approach, a rebuild or remodel, as we say, and a new project?
That project specifically is a historic home. And so, and that owner really wanted to honor that. So just starting out with that, we knew we weren't going to change a lot of the detailing on the outside. And we really did want to retain many of the spaces on the inside. So I think when you start out with a renovation, instead of comparing the spaces that are needed with maybe like another structure, you really walk the space that you have and decide what is serving you and what isn't. And in historic homes, it's usually the kitchen. The way that people lived in 1912 is very different than the way people live here. And so we keep the spaces that are key and we make some alterations. We try to prioritize those things too. So maybe it's the private spaces, the bedrooms, the closets that don't have as many of the key elements that we want to save in them. And so it's kind of okay to make some changes, because by making those changes, you actually extend the life of that home. So it can last another 100 years. And there's also certain aspects of our modern life, like technology, which you guys are doing an amazing job integrating that in a very seamless way, because the worst thing you have is to have like this beautiful historic paneled library and then see all the stuff. So I think that's the primary difference, just honoring the house and what works for it already.
Yeah, very cool. And you're absolutely right. Houses are quite a bit different today. Mm-hmm. They're built quite differently than they were in the early 20th century. And it looks like in walking through that home, there are a couple of, I guess, passageways, doorways, stairways that have endured that aren't getting changed, mm-hmm. That some kind of like low passageways, I guess. Could you talk a little bit about some of the historical aspects of the home that are being retained and kind of how they're able to be grandfathered in, even though they wouldn't necessarily pass code today?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the general rule is if it's existing non-conforming and you're not touching it, it may stay. But as soon as you make any kind of alteration to it, then it needs to be brought up to current code. That project specifically has a carriage house that's at a zero lot line, which would never be permitted today. Sure. You'd have to have a side yard setback, but they allow that. So any changes that we make that essentially make that condition, existing non-conforming condition, worse, like adding a window to that side, there's higher requirements for that, like fire resistance than there typically would be if you were adhering to the setback. And the stair is a good example. If the stair, the stair to the basement is very steep, but we decided to keep it because they're aware and they have a dumbwaiter that's going to help them bring stuff down. So we could rebuild it and make it a little bit easier, but because of the space available and headroom, we just leave it alone.
Makes sense.
And then there are features like wood-burning fireplaces that you can't do now, but a lot of the homeowners are keeping just because they are historic to the home.
Sure. Yeah, interesting. Very cool. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So as a woman in a leadership position, have you encountered challenges or brought any unique perspectives to your projects?
As far as the challenges, I think I've been very lucky in my career, and I've worked with both men and women who have respected and lifted me up. So I know that's not the case for everyone. And but as far as like influence, or I think that I'm a mom too, and that presents many challenges that I think are unique to women.
Sure.
So at Tim Barber, I was the first and the second maternity leave, and I was supported the whole way through. But we were sort of learning together what that was like, who would cover my projects while I was gone, and what I needed to be fully supported when I got back. So because I was the first, now there are other moms in our office that I know better how to support them because I've been through that.
Very cool.
I hope that they will look at me as an example or as an advocate for them so that they can feel like they've got somebody in their corner.
Sure. That's awesome. So shifting gears a little bit, I know that you're actively in TBA, obviously, mm-hmm. Very much involved with the Institute of Classical Architecture and Art, the ICAA, as well as the AIA LA's Women in Architecture Committee. Mm-hmm. You're also a certified safety assessment program evaluator for statewide disaster response. Talk to us a little bit more about what's involved in some of those roles.
Those are all very unique roles. So with the ICAA, it's a wonderful organization that really focuses on educating and celebrating classical architecture. I've always attended all of their events, from the networking events to some of their education classes. They've got wonderful teachers. And in January, I went to there's a week-long intensive in New York, their winter intensive, where we drew the orders and we did field sketching and ink wash, which many people don't know what ink wash is, but it's incredibly relaxing. And so I had the opportunity to learn so much about that. And it's great to know sort of where we came from, a lot of the foundational parts of most architecture mm-hmm. in the United States. The Women in Architecture Committee with the AIA, I started to volunteer, I think I've for 3 years now, on their Powerful Conference. And it happens each fall, and it's volunteer-based, and it's just a a group of women speakers. They talk about our influence in this industry as it's been historically male dominated. And it's incredibly inspiring to be in a room of that many successful and accomplished women in the architecture, engineering, and construction. So it's a lot of fun, and we learn a lot, and I've made a lot of friends that I can confide in and things throughout.
That's great. Yeah, it's good to have support.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's always good to have a support group.
Yeah.
So quickly, talk a little bit about inkwashing.
Inkwash. So it's similar kind of to watercolor in the way that you use layers of water and ink, and it takes a lot of patience. And you do your first pass through your paper is, or the cloth actually, is just a very light water. And the next one is slightly darker, and the next one is slightly darker. And it takes a lot of patience, and it's kind of something most people don't do anymore, but it's a nice skill to at least experience once. I can't say I will use it much in our work, but it was fun.
Very cool. Very cool. Learn something new every day.
Yeah.
So you recently attended a design charrette with top architects and designers from the the Design Leadership Network, focusing on the importance of architectural heritage while elevating ideas and options for rebuilding the Palisades and Altadena. Can you share more about that event?
Yeah, sure. That was just on Saturday and Sunday. I attended part one of it, which was Saturday. And it's the DLN and Save Iconic Architecture. Those groups came together and invited designers from all over the U.S. There was a gentleman that came from London for this. It was really talented group. And the first day was about studying the precedents of Los Angeles architecture. So there were six styles, and we broke into teams, and mine was craftsman architecture. And we looked at, over the years and generations, the styles have morphed into some things that are maybe still the style and maybe not. So the idea was to put together a pattern book in the end that can be used for inspiration for architects and designers. And really just showing like the key components of those styles and potentially how they could be altered for fire resilience. And day two, I did not attend. I wasn't able to, but they looked at a site, like a site in the Palisades or Altadena, typical dimensions for a site, and developed floor plans and elevations for that kind of a cityscape. And they're still working on it. And I'm happy to continue to contribute on it, but it's still in early stages, so I think how that takes form is a bit unknown.
Discover why we're the most awarded home technology firm in the U.S. Our design-centric approach transforms your space with effortless control of lighting, motorized shades, audio, video, and more. Our friendly experts guide you every step of the way, no tech speak, just smart, stunning simplicity. We provide years of care from our award-winning service and support team. Experience technology that feels as good as it looks.
So the Palisades, obviously, it's always been known for its unique charm. Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate that the Palisades rebuilds will favor particular architectural styles or materials? Due to regulations or climate concerns, how do you see the kind of character of architecture developing as, we go through the rebuild process?
Well, the Palisades had many styles before, and I truly hope that it will retain that sort of mixed character of styles. I think what a lot of us fear is that it will come back and be built too quickly without enough thought, that it will be void of that kind of culture and soul. So I hope that some of the styles will come back. And we are seeing that with the homeowners that we're working with. They're not just choosing to build cheap and fast. They are taking real time to make sure that what they build is something that will be a legacy home for them. So we're we're looking all sorts of styles. Cape Cod is one specific that has wood shingles. I think we'll have to get creative with how we view some of those designs that are really dependent on materials that we shouldn't be using anymore, like wood siding. But that's the challenge. That's what our field is doing.
Interesting. So you mentioned wood shake. Obviously, wood shake siding, roofing is flammable, right? So how are you kind of replacing those materials to the extent that you're using something that's fire, you know, resistant or a more resilient material, but still retains the same look? How do you kind of, you know, rectify those two, you know, the challenge of using materials that are not flammable while retaining the architectural style that you're going for?
I mean, many of the homes that were built that way were done so before the high fire codes were in place, which I believe was 2008. So a lot of the homes were built before that, and that was part of what contributed to such the widespread. But designing for high fire is not a new thing. We've always had to use non-combustible exterior materials. And I personally find the faux wood shake to be like not believable. So I would rather see things like painted fiber cement shingles, which exist and there are great ones, so that we're not trying to necessarily copy something that we have done in the past that won't be authentic, but to like take the character of the shingle house. You know, there's the shadow lines, and many of them were painted. So those are the types of details that we can do. We can still have that type of house. It's just looking slightly different than what you would see before. And same with like wood shake. Nobody's putting a wood shake on their house anymore, right? But there are products there. There are cement shingles. There are faux wood shake that maybe is okay because you're seeing it at a distance. So yeah, there's lots of strategies.
Yeah, interesting. How about sourcing materials? Do you foresee any, you know, real challenges with sourcing the specific materials that, you know, that we've talked about and that will be needed in order to, you know, maintain the style and, you know, just from a, you know, a supply perspective, do you foresee... Yeah, I guess that's really my question is, do you foresee supply shortages in specific types of materials given the scope of, you know, the work that needs to be done?
I think there are still some unknowns with that. But I think supply shortage I'm less concerned about than labor shortage, because we can get supplies from other states, and it's just there's only so many people here to do the work that are going to travel to those sites.
Right. Yeah. And if we're bringing people in, where do they go? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. We've heard this before in other conversations that it seems that the supply of materials is less of an issue, and the, you know, people power is really going to be the main challenge. It's interesting how we're this will end up happening, right? You know, how it will all, you know, no pun intended, shake out. So lots of challenges ahead. So rebuilding means, you know, lots of permits and approvals. How do architects typically guide homeowners through this process, right? Homeowners may have done this before. Lots of our customers have built multiple homes, of course, but they're not the ones actually going down and pulling the permits. And they don't always understand why something may take, you know, a long time. So how does TBA help its clientele through that process and, you know, guide them through, you know, the challenges and delays that may be, you know, a part of the permitting process?
Well, I mean, you said we guide them. So if they hire the architect first, we know which consultants need to be brought on board right away. Survey, soils, an expediter if you have a challenging site. And we know where to research what you can design. So setbacks, restrictions for height, all of that. It's incredibly challenging and complicated for somebody who hasn't been doing this as their profession to work their way through all of that. Even simply knowing that your HOA is going to have a different set of rules than the city will have. So just having the owner really rely on us for that guidance. We've also been recommending that they bring on a GC earlier than we typically would suggest, so that they can provide cost estimates throughout as the market is changing a bit. We always check our design at the end of each phase to make sure that we're on target with the owner's budget. But yeah, and all the consultants, they come through us. Their drawings come to us. We make sure they're coordinated, and that's really key.
Oh, very, very good. So how about advice on assembling? I mean, you kind of just touched on this, you know, how to assemble a rebuild team to ensure a, you know, a smooth process. Clearly the game has changed to the extent that, you know, we just have variables in the equation that we didn't have before. The city and state have, you know, promised that, permits will be expedited. There will be extra resources, stuff like that. But you know, there's lots of new challenges, like, you know, the soil has got to be remediated. Mm-hmm. I heard that, I'm not sure if it's the Corps of Engineers or what entity it was that was supposed to take the first 6 inches or 12 inches of topsoil. How are those types of, you know, differences in the process affecting how, you know, the rebuild process is going to go? I guess maybe another way to put it is, you know, given the new challenges of soil remediation and, you know, toxic runoff and these other kind of effects that are left after the fire, how are those affecting the build process and the permitting and the selection of the team, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Well, in sequencing, it's adjusting the way that we do things a little bit. Normally, we wouldn't start a project until we had a survey. But because some of the lots aren't clear and they aren't able to do that work, or the soils, for example, we're able to use resources that we were finding online. So maybe they had an old survey, or maybe they have a plot plan, or Navigate LA has been a wonderful resource where we can get a pretty accurate idea. So at least we can get through some of the early stages of design without having, like, you know, 100% accurate survey. That's a little bit out of sequence. As far as the soil testing, they are removing the 6 inches just where the building is. So, but they aren't removing it throughout the whole site. So there will have to be a soils test to make sure that there's no toxins for families, so that they can still play in the yard and do gardening. All of that's really important. I think that's one of the things that I've heard that's different from past fires, is they were testing and now they aren't. And I think purely based on, like, the widespread nature of it. And then for the rebuild, there's certain things like setbacks that have changed. So they used to be able to, you have a typical setback you're allowed, or you can base it on the prevailing setback. I don't know if I'm getting a little too technical, but
no, it's okay.
Where they base your setback on the setbacks of your neighbors for the whole block. But if all your neighbors are gone, there's nothing to base that on. So that's like, there's certain nuances like that. Another really important one that the city has helped out with are the introduction of, like, an ADU in the back. A lot of homeowners didn't have an ADU. They had a garage. And a typical sequence would be that you can replace the garage with an ADU. And they're allowing us to kind of jump over that step and just go straight into the ADU without providing parking. So there's like a lot of, there's a lot of little nuances to the code and to the process that we're having to make adjustments for.
Interesting. Well, this has been a great conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed this, this time. Are there any other topics that you think are, you know, applicable to, you know, to what we're dealing with right now, or, just anything else that you'd like to add to the conversation as we wrap it up?
Yeah, I would say that the biggest shift for us in our office, me specifically as an architect, is the way that we think about building our communities. So there may be homes that aren't in a high fire zone that we're now designing to have that potential. You know, there's, it kind of took away that sense of where the vulnerable neighborhoods are and where they aren't. So it seems that everyone is affected by this. And it also really highlighted the fact that just designing to code is not enough. We've done that with sustainability, you know, so there's certain envelope efficiency requirements that the city has, water conservation, and we've always tried to exceed them with better performing windows or insulation or materials, but we're doing that now with high fire. Instead of just designing to code, we're doing things like rooftop sprinklers or rock wool insulation, or adding a layer of dens glass or dens deck to the envelope. You know, gutter guards, a must. So just taking those requirements, I think we must do better across the board. It can't just be one house. It has to be the entire neighborhood. Otherwise, your neighbor affects your structure.
Absolutely.
And I don't think that it is just limited to new builds as well. I think some of the homes are still standing in those communities, and there are many, many other communities that have homes that were built before these more strict fire requirements. And there's things that they can do. They don't have to simply just sit there because they were there and there's nothing they can do. They're not rebuilding. There are maintenance measures and lower cost options, like putting in gutter guards and vents that are small enough to prevent the passage of embers. That I think that if we're truly serious about preventing something like this happening again, everybody has to take part.
Oh, well said. Well said. Well, Kelly, thank you very much again for coming in. This has been fantastic to have you in, and we'll look forward to seeing you again on a site.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thank you.